Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It often has been referred to as the Bible of Black travel. The Green Book wasn't just a convenient handbook for travelers, but also a lifesaver at a time when travel was difficult and dangerous for Black Americans. If you were Black and on the road during the Jim Crow era, you had to bring extra food provisions, stash gas in the car trunk for refills. Some travelers carried portable toilets. For three decades, the book guided travelers to the safe harbors for rest and food. Candace Taylor is a cultural documentarian. She's chronicled the history of the Green Book and what happened to the thousands of Black-owned or otherwise friendly businesses listed on its pages. Her new book is titled Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Obviously, the Overground is a reference, a play on words to the Underground Railroad in the United States during legalized slavery. It tells us that there's still restrictions. There's still not freedom.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the title kind of came to me. It was, I had a fellowship at Harvard with Henry Louis Gates, and I was standing with my other fellows, and I said, oh, it was like an Overground Railroad. And my friend John Jennings said, that's the title of your book. And I called my agent, and she said, let's do it, because that was the only way I could describe it, because I think in some ways we look at slavery, we look at all of these older, what people might think were more extreme forms of racism, but the threat of injury to your body, the threat of your life, the threat to your well-being, the threat to even just minor things, you know, like you said, you're carrying gas cans in the car.
So
That's dangerous, right? So there's all these tools that we had to bring in and things that we were forced to use long after slavery was over. And so I think in that way, the Overground Railroad made sense to me. And another reason why I use that reference is because what I believe is mass incarceration is our current civil rights crisis at the time. And Michelle Alexander, who wrote The New Jim Crow, my hero, I love her. I love her work. And she often says, you know, we need an Underground Railroad to get people out of prison. And so I thought, again, the Overground Railroad reference was great because there's ways that we still need to provide access, resources, and help for those who are still condemned in our society and who happen to be Black.
Right. Victor Hugo Green created the Green Book, mm-hmm. which explains the title. Who was he and what spurred him at that time? And by the way, it wasn't the only such book out there, but tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, Victor Green was an incredible man. He was he had a seventh grade education. He lived in Harlem. He was a postal worker. He was a simple man, but he was a very distinguished man. He always dressed nice. He was very tall, handsome. He was married to a woman named Alma Duke Green. And they were just a smashing couple. They lived in Sugar Hill District in Harlem, which was Duke Ellington lived catty corner from them. It was the elite of Black culture they were surrounded by. They weren't rich, but they had a lot of class. And Victor Green, you know, right when he started the Green Book, he was in Harlem. It was 1935 when he started writing it. And the Harlem riot broke out at that time. And so I think that really shaped his, you know, experience of what it meant, because even in Harlem, it was very segregated. And even though the 1920s Harlem Renaissance had happened,
right.
Still half the places along 125th Street, you couldn't get in if you were Black. Or if you did get in, you had to sit. You couldn't sit in the orchestra seats, or you had to enter through the back. Even the place where the Apollo was segregated. So that was still a reality, and the first Green Book in 1936 that was published was focused only on Harlem because it was kind of an immediate need in his community.
There's the idea that the Green Book, a lot of people apply only to the Deep South, and right. It wasn't that way at all. It expanded, but it expanded across the country, not it wasn't where a lot of people stereotypically think segregation was occurring.
Right. And there were sundown towns, right, throughout the country. And sundown towns were largely a northern and western, midwestern concept. For instance, there were over 400 sundown towns in the state of Illinois and only 13 in Mississippi.
And sundown being?
Sundown towns are, they were, and there are still a couple that modern day towns, but they were towns that you could not be black and be there after 6 p.m. They would either have a sign saying N-word, don't let the sun set on you here at the county border, or they would ring a bell at 6 p.m. and tell the local help and domestics to leave because there were black people that could come in and work, but you had to be out of town by 6 p.m. And they were there were thousands of them throughout the country.
Were these set in law in some places?
Well, you know, if you look at some of the segregation, there's a map that that I looked at, especially in the 1950s. You know, segregation was, there were some states where it was on the books, where they just had their law set up when you, you know, what, and it was just flagrant segregation. However, if you went to a state like California, again, we think of as being so liberal, South Central LA, where Green Book sites were clustered, all of the town, like Culver City right next to South Central, was a sundown town. North of the city, north of LA, Glendale was a sundown town up until the 1960s. The beaches in Santa Monica were segregated, not by law, but by practice. So that's always been the conundrum. That's been the confusing thing, is that in some ways, being in the South, when they had the colored and white signs, it was at least more clear where you could be and where you couldn't be. Whereas when the second wave of the Great Migration was happening, when the height of the Green Book was in publication mm-hmm. in the 40s, so many black families that were moving north thought they were moving to this Mecca where it was open and free, and yet there were these other hidden signs. So in some ways you can argue that some folks said, you know, it's not any different by the time they got to Chicago and had left Mississippi, but they said now it's even more confusing because we don't know where.
You don't know the rules.
The rules. So having it spelled out wasn't necessarily worse. It was actually helping you to understand what kind of situation you were in or if there was a reason to feel danger.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the Jim Crow era and the books that were published to help guide people across country, across the town. Candace E. Taylor is a cultural documentarian and author of Overground Railroad, The Green Book, and The Roots of Black Travel in America. She will be at Gramercy Books in Bexley tonight. For more information on that, check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question, I would love to hear from people who remember that era and remember The Green Book or other guides to help people of color, mostly African-Americans, traverse the country. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Candace, there were other guides out there, about 20, I think you referenced, or you made reference to maybe around 20, something like that. What stood out about The Green Book?
Well, The Green Book wasn't the first one, okay? Mm-hmm. So Hackley and Harrison's was the first Black Traveler's Guide, and it was published in 1930. And there were roughly, during the time The Green Book was in publication, about a dozen other Black Traveler Guides. And then there were some others in the 70s that come up. Mm-hmm. But what made The Green Book different and special was that Victor Green, in his genius, had this, he was a postal worker, he was with the Postal Workers Union. Postal workers were segregated like other parts of the, you know, other businesses in the country. And so they were relegated to black neighborhoods. So all of those postal workers on the beat knew all the black business owners and would solicit the Green Book and say, hey, this might help your business, you know. And that's how it grew. And also Victor Green had a great alliance with Esso gas stations, which is ExxonMobil today.
Yeah.
And they were on the front lines. They were very, we can talk later about Esso if you want, but they were on the right side of history in this regard. And they spearheaded, they hired two black marketing executives to help promote the Green Book. So the longevity of the Green Book, the fact it was in publication for nearly for three decades,
right,
was a testament to, I think, those two things.
Marketing.
Mm-hmm.
Being able to sell it and knowing what your market was.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what it was like for African Americans during the Jim Crow era, from that mid-30s to the mid-40s, or I'm sorry, the late mid to late 60s. This is when cars became king, for one thing, and people were just traveling more. So it makes sense, too, that it emerges during that time and burgeons then in post-World War II era, right? Mm-hmm. But it was very dangerous.
It was. And, you know, like I said, because the sundown towns were a real thing. That was a real threat.
But just to be an African-American family in a car.
Right. Being pulled over by the police, especially no matter if you were poor or even if you had money. You know, I open up the book talking about my stepfather, Ron.
Yeah.
Because at the age of 7, he grew up in the Jim Crow South in Tennessee, and he was traveling north with his family. His mother and father were in the front seat, and they get pulled over by sheriff. And what we found, there were so many different ruses and props that black folks used to keep themselves safe on the road. And one thing that was pervasive in black culture was the chauffeur's hat. And Ron never knew why, but there was always a black cab sitting, you know, just perched in the back seat on a little hook. And he said when they got pulled over by the sheriff said, you know, who's this car? Who are these people with you? And because his father worked for the railroad, he had a good job. They had a nice car, probably a nicer car than a sheriff could afford. And that was always a threat. That was dangerous. So for him to, you know, be pulled over, and his father said, you know, don't say a word to Ron. And he watched his father handle this police officer in a way where he'd never seen before. He said, you know, his father ignored the fact that he pretended that he didn't know his wife. When they said, you know, who are these people with you? He said, this is my chauffeur's car, or this is my employer's car. He looked at his wife and said, she's the maid, and that's her son, and I'm driving them home. And the officer said, you know, well, where's your hat? And he said, it's hanging in the back, officer. And Ron, my stepfather, said, you know, from that day on, he was the age of 7, but he said from that day on, in almost every black man's car he rode in, he saw that hat. And sometimes they'd have a coat, a chauffeur's coat in the back, as a ruse. So there were just these different, you know, for any marginalized community, you have to create tools for survival. And this was no different. But I think what was fascinating was even these were stories that I just learned when I was writing this book. I'd known my stepfather since I was 12, and this story tumbles out of his mouth, you know, in my 40s. I was like 48 when, you know, I learned this.
You said it explained a lot when you heard these stories about his antipathy toward whites, mm-hmm. his lack of comfort mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. around him.
Yeah, I used to roll my eyes and think, you know, he's paranoid, he's, you know, of a different era, you know, why, you know, this isn't the world we live in today.
Get over it, kind of a thing.
Yeah. I really was, you know, I just thought, why? You know, why is he still like this? And again, it wasn't until I started writing the book and he started telling me these stories that I understood. It made complete sense why he was so suspicious and just not trusting.
It's ingrained.
Yeah.
We are talking about the history of what author and cultural documentarian Candace E. Taylor has called the Overground Railroad, that is the roots of black travel in America, how important it was, what it said about the African-American community in the United States, what it said about the United States writ large, though. Her new book is titled Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. She will be at Gramercy Books in Bexley tonight, so check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for information about that. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It often was referred to as the Bible of Black travel. The Green Book wasn't just a convenient handbook for travelers. It was a lifesaver during a time when travel was difficult and dangerous for African Americans. Candace C. Taylor curated Smithsonian Institution's traveling exhibition, The Negro Motorist Green Book. It begins a three-year national tour this year. She is a cultural documentarian and author of a new book. It's called Overground Railroad, The Green Book, and the Roots of Black Travel in America. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or, check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You referred to the Green Book as practically a yellow pages of Black-owned businesses and wrote about the business ownership among Blacks in the U.S. by 1930. So it was a real booster, too. It was, I think you called it a weapon, but, I mean, it was like a positive thing, too, not just a reflection of a negative thing.
Right. I mean, I think the, you know, what's interesting, when you look closer at the Green Books, you know, thank God the Schomburg, I had a fellowship there, but they're based out of New York, the New York Public Library, and they've digitized the Green Books, and you can go on their website and see them. But when you look through Green Books, you know, digitally, you just see a list of businesses, and they kind of don't, it's just a bunch of names, and it's hard to really bring meaning to them because, you know, my work has been really uncovering what these businesses did, who owned them. But what was fascinating to me in the earlier Green Books, they had every type of business you could imagine that was not indicative of travel guide. There was everything from liquor stores to funeral parlors, sanitariums, doctors, nightclubs. There were so many, anything you may need on the road, department stores. So it was a real, I think, testament to how many places Black folks were shut out of. So, and there were golf courses listed in the Green Book. And so when I use the word weapon, it was really in the sense of, it was a places where most white society didn't want you. And so even if not all of these businesses were Black owned, but many of them were, the fact that we just went ahead and did it anyway was, I think, a form of aggression at that time, because there were a lot of laws and a lot of effort to keep you out of that space. So the Green Book was that entryway into those experiences, which was, I think, monumental. And you see later in the later editions, it looks more like a travel guide, and there's only food and lodging. But at that time in the 30s and 40s, and early 50s, before really Brown versus Board, I think is when even Black folks were like, well, maybe this will change. You know, you can see the changes in the Green Book.
The businesses in the book are primarily Black-owned, of course, but not all. And notably, interestingly, you already mentioned Esso, which is now known as Exxon, but Macy's. Hmm. And Disneyland.
Yeah,
I thought that was interesting. You don't know. I mean, when you look at the old, I actually was watching an old documentary about Disney, and there were African Americans in the pictures that I found unexpected for the time.
Mm-hmm. It was surprising because most people who learn about the Green Book or just know it on a cursory level assume that it was just the lesser known or lesser, you know, valued places that were left over for Black folks, quote unquote. So, you know, so it was really, for instance, if you looked at the movie, the Hollywood film, if walking away from that, you would think, oh, Don Shirley could only go to these really kind of downtrodden places that were in the Green Book. And that wasn't the case. There were modest tourist homes for folks who were migrant families who didn't have a lot of money. But then there were also fabulous places like the Waldorf Astoria was listed in the Green Book.
Mm-hmm.
Like you said, you know, Disneyland, the Bel Air Hotel in Los Angeles.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just the gamut. It was really, and there were different people of different classes who happened to be Black.
Was there any risk being in the Green Book?
I don't think there was any more risk than just being Black in America. You know?
Okay, because I was wondering if that was a piece of that story that, you know, you're now identified, and if there was any threat to that.
Well, I have to say most of the really high-end places, Brooks Brothers, Macy's, all of those places came in the tail end. It was really in the 63 edition that you see them coming up. So, of course, that was when it was more safe because it was a couple of years before the Civil Rights Act was passed. And, you know, as early as 1960, you start seeing these more white-owned businesses. And maybe they always wanted to be, you know, more inclusive, but didn't feel they could be until it was society was moving in that direction. You don't see it, but you do see some white-owned businesses earlier in the Green Book, but it wasn't the higher-end, more kind of iconic, fancier places. Sure, they come in later.
I'm talking with Candace E. Taylor about her new book. It is titled Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. To write the book, you traveled around the country visiting these places that are listed in the book, thousands of them. Tell me how you plotted your journey, how you decided where you were going to go and what you were going to do.
Well, it was quite a journey. I mean, I've taken probably 7 major trips over the years, but the biggest trip I took was right after I left my fellowship at Harvard. It was kind of a blessing and a curse that I moved to New York, did the fellowship at Schomburg, and then while I was in New York, my landlord in L.A. decided he had to move into my apartment. He couldn't live anywhere else, so he ends up... I was like, I'd be the
Not
best
bitter
tenant.
About that,
really?
Are
you can't find any other apartment in this building to move into? Of course, I had the best unit. Mm-hmm. So I lost that. He paid me to leave, but he put everything in storage. And so I was kind of a rolling stone because I really had no... quote unquote home. When I left Harvard, things were in storage in LA. And I took that opportunity to just hit the road. And I lived on the road for a while. It wasn't until I moved to Denver, I think 2.5 years later, that I got my things out of storage. But that first trip, it was about 23,000 miles on that trip. And like I said, there's so many, the Green Book sites were clustered in traditional black neighborhoods. So it was really, I could scout about 30 a day because they were clustered.
Yeah.
But I worked 16-hour days and I have a kind of, because I knew, I had the book contract at that point and I knew I had such a short period of time before I had to sit down and start writing the book. And once I sat down to write, I knew I only had what I had. So I was on a mission and I scouted over 4,000 sites. But some days I'd be in the West and I'd be driving for days and only see one or two. So it just
depended.
That
were still open, you mean? Or that
or
still
even
existed
that were,
at all?
That there were so few even out there. That even existed. But I estimated about 3% are still in operation and about 80% are gone. I mean, there's just no, whether through urban renewal or all of these other social forces, gentrification.
Yeah.
You know, I'd go to one site and there'd be a big freeway there where there were like 20 Green Book sites. Oh,
Columbus, you grew up in Columbus.
I did.
Is a great example of how neighborhoods and communities really, I think more importantly, were destroyed by the expressway.
Yeah, they were. They were, and you know,
that's not. This is just a classic example here. It's all over the place like that, right?
That happened all over the country, and it's more. You can see the scars more. And again, I'm so grateful that I knew that I could have written the book probably had I not taken the field research, but I knew that I had to get out into these communities and literally see what had happened. And in some ways, the devastating government policies that shaped, you know, black life and black communities is still with us.
Mm-hmm.
Because it happened in the 60s. It was really aggressive. And yet every decade after that, there's been something that's just, you know, whether it's crack that came into the neighborhoods in the 80s, mass incarceration now, and just compiling that, it's been devastating to see.
Route 66 has been romanticized in song and on a popular TV show in the 60s. But it was not at all a safe place for Black travelers back in the day, right?
No. And the way that I found my way into the Green Book was through Route 66, ironically. I was commissioned to write a book, a travel guide on Route 66, and I had written, my first book was called Counterculture, and it was on the American Diner waitress, and I had interviewed all these waitresses on Route 66, and so this Avalon Publishing asked me to do this book on Route 66, and I did it as a job, and I thought, you know, it wasn't something I would normally have done, but I did because I needed the money, mm-hmm. And I was kind of cursing myself because it wasn't really enough money to live on. And I thought, why am I doing this? You know, and I went to a museum, the Autry Museum in Los Angeles, and they had a Route 66
show. Like the Gene Autry Museum?
Yes.
Okay.
And they had a Route 66 exhibition. And they had a green book tucked away under glass in a corner. And I never knew such a thing existed. This was like 2013. And I thought, oh, my God, what is this? And so I run outside. I call my parents. And I said, have you ever heard of this? And my mom, who grew up in Columbus, said no. And she was a very fair-skinned woman and, you know, could pass. But this was not her experience. But my stepfather, Ron, was, oh, yeah, yeah, I know what that is. And, yeah, there were a few of those back then. And, you know, my head blew open. I thought, right. Oh, my God, this is why I'm doing this project. Like, this is the project. You know, it's like, okay, I'll do this travel guide, but really this is what led me here. So, you know, and again, learning about, and it shaped the way that I even wrote that travel guide, because I learned that half the counties on Route 66 were sundown towns. So how in the world, you know, there was no sundown
and
town
just,
map.
And even if it wasn't exactly a sundown town, it probably wasn't very friendly, or you just didn't know.
No, going through the Ozarks was serious. It was serious. And Missouri, I mean, you have the really fun, kitschy drive-through cave, fantastic caverns that look so fun, and all the you see these great postcards, and but Fantastic Caverns during that time had the KKK. The KKK ran Fantastic Caverns, and we have a photo. There's a photograph in my book of them literally holding one of their, you know, they had cross burnings and other gatherings down there.
Right.
How would you know? I mean, there was no internet. There was no way. There was word of mouth. And people were told, like, go around this town. But, you know, you got the information piecemeal, and I'm sure you didn't have all the information you needed.
So what about Columbus? What did you learn about your hometown?
Well, Columbus was, you know, it was kind of coming back in terms of the Green Book sites that were the two Green Book sites that are the most important, you know, the St. Clair, Hotel St. Clair. Ironically, my sister and her husband actually helped to save this Hotel St. Clair because it was completely in shambles. And so they got the tax credits and brought it up to code and moved in low-income senior housing. So thankfully they saved it. And I don't know, that was in the early 2000s. And then I'm working on this project mm-hmm. 15 years later, and I find out it was a Green Book site, you know, so that was amazing. You look at the Macon Hotel, my mother and Ron remember it very fondly. My sister used to go there. And so having these Green Book sites, you know, be a part of my family, again, that I didn't know going into it was fascinating.
When you visited sites that were still operating out there, were they aware?
Okay. In most cases, they weren't. In most cases, they didn't know what the Green Book was. So
it was children, or it was not even anyone who was associated with who'd owned it at the time, maybe.
When I went to these
different sites, yeah.
Yeah, I actually got a grant from the Library of Congress to really go and find the family members or go to the business owners and see if I can find the original, you know, lineage to who was running it during the time it was in the Green Book. So, you know, so that was a really great opportunity to get those stories. And so I interviewed everyone from, you know, Don Loper at Loper's Tire Service, and just, his father ran this business. It looks like he's not going to be able to hang on much longer because tires aren't what they used to be. They're kind of like small computers now.
Yeah.
So for him to just be a mechanic and a, you know, it's just, he doesn't know how he's going to hang on. But there were those kind of, you know, I interviewed small business owners like him. But I also interviewed Nelson Mauldin, who was Martin Luther King's barber. And he worked in the barber shop at the Hotel Ben Moore, which was a Green Book site. And that's where they strategized the Montgomery bus boycott. And that place is losing. I mean, it's going to be, hopefully it won't be demolished, but it's been sitting empty and slowly disintegrating over the decades. So these are really iconic moments in history that we are in danger of losing. And so preservation also became an important part after I wrote the book.
Did you, I suppose there's a lot of missions in this book, mm-hmm. it feels like. One of them is to raise awareness, though, in mm-hmm. communities. Where's your Green Book sites? What's left?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, I am developing a mobile app so that people can experience that, whether it's in their own communities or if they want to take a road trip across country, they can frequent some of the ones that are still around to keep them going. I think it's an important and fun part of our history. It's a tangible part of our history that I think we need to have experiences with. I think it's a new way to look at culture and travel and, you know, and I think it's a great opportunity for us to really rehash the truth of this experience, because I don't think we've ever really done that.
How did you feel traveling alone like that?
I'm a loner. I prefer traveling alone.
Did you always feel safe, though?
No. and that's ironic because I've been doing this work for 20 years and I've been no fragile flower. I've seen a lot, you know, I don't. But it wasn't until I went into these communities that, again, were so on the margins of society. And me being a Black woman, you know, I've never seen that level of poverty. And I think most of people I know hadn't experienced that and understood how severe it was. And there were places like in Chicago where the South Side of this, and I've been to Chicago probably 20 times in my life, but I'd never been to this part of Chicago. And it was literally, and it's one of my favorite cities, but 52 people were shot that weekend. I was in that neighborhood, and that was scary. And it was unreal. I felt like I was scared to even leave my car to go get gas. And I had to make decisions like, okay, do I bring my camera with me? Do I leave it in the car, bring my phone with me? Like the idea that my car might not be there. I mean, there were all these decisions I had to make. And I thought this is completely ironic that I'm researching this travel guide that made, these were areas that made Black folks feel safe. And I'm not feeling safe to get out of my car. I was lunged at by, you know, someone. I was never physically attacked, almost a couple of times, chased by dogs, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. It was just, you know, it was interesting. But my stepfather, Ron, who had been in law enforcement, he was a Marine. He made sure I called. I checked in every night. So he knew that I made it to my hotel. He taught me how to use a stun gun. He taught me how to use a knife. I traveled with those things in hands, in arm's length distance in my car all the time.
That's Candace E. Taylor. She's a cultural documentarian, author of a new book. It's titled Overground Railroad, The Green Book, and the Roots of Black Travel in America. She will be at Gramercy Books in Bexley tonight. Check out the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides for more information on that. If you have a question or comment for Candace E. Taylor, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's often called the Bible of Black Travel. The Green Book wasn't just a convenient handbook for travelers, though. It was a lifesaver during a time when travel was difficult and dangerous for African Americans. Candace E. Taylor curated Smithsonian Institution's traveling exhibition, The Negro Motorist Green Book, which begins a three-year national tour in 2020. She is a cultural documentarian and author of a new book titled Overground Railroad, The Green Book and the Roots of Black Travel in America. If you have a question or comment for her, get it in, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. I thought you made a really interesting observation. I think it was in the introduction of the book. You said that Victor Green, who created the Green Book, and then his wife after he died, and then I think a nephew or somebody in his family continued it, you said he probably didn't set out to create a weapon for change. And you compared her to Steve Jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Who put the camera in the phone. Yeah. Can you talk about, it was kind of a smack upside the head, but I think you're really right about this.
Thanks. Yeah, I think, you know, with Victor Green, what he did that was so ingenious, it was just so simple. And I, you know, and I'm sure when Steve Jobs put a camera in an iPhone, he didn't think it was going to be the kind of seed that sparked another civil rights era movement in America, right? That wasn't his intention. But that's what
the Black Lives Matter movement.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what happened. And I think similarly, we can look at Victor Green. I'm sure he didn't set out to say, I'm going to change the way people move and around in this country and give them access to all this power. And what, you know, that wasn't what he was thinking. I'm sure he just thought, I need to be able to go to I need to know what store I can go to on 125th Street. So it was a very kind of localized solution to a problem that, you know, I think problem solving can be as complicated as you want to make it. And I think that this idea that to change these social forces, like especially with race and gender and all these big things, you know, people, we think we need some big mastermind. We need another Martin Luther King before we can really make change. But there are simple tools that can create extreme amount of progress in our society. And I think if we pare down our thoughts about how big it has to be, I think more people should try these ideas that they have that may seem very simple on the surface, but once they replicate and if it's a real need, it can be used in powerful ways. And I think that's why I was so attracted to the Green Book, is because it wasn't trying necessarily to do anything other than provide a solution for folks.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Thank you for this book. I would like to ask what you have found, if anything, for locations in the Fort Lauderdale, Pompano Beach area. And I ask that for two reasons. My family used to vacation there in the winter often, and so I'm just curious about it. But secondly, I'm kind of wondering if we were inadvertent participants in discrimination. My parents notoriously never made reservations at the height of travel season, so we would be driving for hours and hours through motel after motel, no vacancy, no vacancy, no vacancy, and I guess towards the end my dad would get desperate and go into those and say, are you sure you don't have a room? And you have me racking my brain this morning trying to remember if there were any times where they saw perhaps a handsome white couple and decided, oh, maybe there was a room available, and I can't remember that for sure. But anyway,
he would go back and ask again. Is that what you're saying?
No, because the sign would say no vacancy.
Oh.
On the outside of the motel, but he would be desperate enough by the, you know, 12th motel to start asking.
It's kind of funny. But Florida, any particular thing outstanding just in general about Florida?
Well, you know, I've been cataloging Green Book sites. I literally just finished. When I first started this project, Wikipedia said there were 1,500 of them. Because they only had two editions of the Green Book to go on. And then the Schomburg digitized their entire collection.
Okay.
And I've cataloged nearly 10,000 of these sites were listed. And so, without me going to my database and looking at Fort Lauderdale, I know there were Green Book sites there. None come to mind that are still standing or operating in Fort Lauderdale. But Miami had the Hampton House, which was an iconic, incredible Green Book site called, that was, you know, served King and Malcolm X. Apparently was proselytized there. He went in as Cassius Clay and or Muhammad Ali went in as Cassius Clay and left as Muhammad Ali.
There's a picture of them in your book.
Yeah. So some really important things happened in Florida. And Florida was very segregated. There were sundown towns, you know, Miami Beach was a real popular place where black folks could play but not stay in terms of the musician. So they go to the Hampton House. So, yeah, Florida is a very unique state, I think, in our country and has always been layered with issues of race.
There's a great stories around this Jackie Robinson and what he experienced traveling as the first on the first integrated team, baseball team, and being the African American who desegregated it, and what he had to go through, and that was probably true. We hear about that in the arts and in entertainment business, that kind of a thing. There was a need for people because they couldn't stay with the rest of their group.
Right, right, and that's true. I mean, and he, ironically. Because there were so many, he writes about, you know, things have been written about his travels. But he was, yeah, he was singled out as, you know, they'd say, oh, yeah, the rest of the team can stay, but you got to find somewhere else to go. And one of those places that kicked him out ends up becoming a Green Book site 5 years later after they kicked him out. So I guess the times changed and allowed him to experience the same, you know, to have the same experiences as his team. But it was rough, and I think, you know, there were so many stories I read of black families trying to find, you know, seeing the no vacancy signs was a real issue, and sometimes they, you know, it would turn on when they would start walking up towards the place. That was real, or some black families would, there was one person who I talk about that I feature in the book, who says, you know, he was light-skinned, his dad was darker-skinned, but he would send him in to get the place that he could pass for white. And then they'd have to sneak the family in, because then it was obvious they were black. Some situations, a black family would come in and they could pass. You know, one hotel operator said, as long as if anybody asks you, just say you're Mexican. Like, don't admit that you're black, and I can let you do this. So that was, it was crazy.
Mary, thanks for that call. Fred in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Fred.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks.
Good. I just have a quick question and comment. I'm from the South, and I think that from what I hear, some of the areas that she used to visit are, I'm assuming, very bad and poor conditions, or where she felt not safe in them. Doesn't she find that because of the integration that now those neighborhoods are not as affluent because of the segregation, because blacks were forced to stay in those areas, so they were more economically more appealing as they are today? I just want to know what she thinks about that. Does she address it in her book?
Yeah. Thank you for the question, Fred. Yes. There's a chapter called The Double-Edged Sword of Integration in my book, I think it's chapter 11, that really looks at the double-edged sword, that conundrum of, you know, the fact that the Green Book was able to thrive and the fact that these communities could be so vibrant is because so many different kinds of black folks with different incomes were living in the same neighborhood. And so there were incredibly savvy black business owners, and then there were people who didn't have money. When integration happened and black folks could leave, say, you know, and move into different communities because they had been banned from those places through redlining, it really shifted the economic dynamics.
It diluted it.
Yeah, it really did. But you couldn't blame them because, you know, for instance, if you could never even go frequent some of the places in New Orleans, for example. I mean, the Dewdrop really lost its shine. The Hampton House lost it. I mean, all these iconic places that were really popular and really successful fell by the wayside and became really, you know, it was a very sad demise for all of these titans of black iconic businesses. And so one woman who I interviewed, you know, she's like, we got what we wanted in terms of integration, but then we lost what we had. And so that's the sad truth of our story of segregation.
Fred, thanks for that call. Let's see, Don in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Hi, Don.
Good afternoon. This is kind of a out-of-the-way question, but I don't know if it still counts or not. Since a lot of black people went to Canada, I wonder if people in Canada had the same trouble in traveling as they do here, or as they have had here.
Well, you know, Canada was obviously even the Underground Railroad. I mean, that was the last stop that a lot of, they went all the way beyond the borders mm-hmm. of America. And so Canada's always been a part of our story. But Canada is still a different country. And, you know, in terms of sundown town signs or anything like that, it was, you know, I think there was at least a collective hope that the bodies, you know, your physical, because of violence in America is its own thing. I really believe that. So there was this idea that you may not die. You would be safe. Doesn't mean necessarily you were welcome. You're still an outsider. And because in so many places that were remote in Canada, you know, that was a reality. However, there were Green Book sites listed in Canada, but especially mostly, you know, Montreal and in the cities, but not in the remote areas. But the Green Book really was an international guide. That's something that we don't talk about very much, but there were Green Book sites. There were in 30 countries in Africa, there were Green Book sites. There were Green Book sites in Bermuda and throughout Europe. And so it was really a tool for travel beyond, you know, America's borders.
I thought it was interesting that you wrote that some hotels that were Green Book hotels would put them in their, like, drawers, like the Gideon's Bible or something.
Yeah.
So people would have it.
Yeah, it was a Bible of black travel. It really was because there – It seemed to me that it wasn't just this companion, that it was like you would take a map, right? You wouldn't go on a trip without a map because how would you know where to go?
Right.
And so the Green Book was, you know, just as indispensable as a map.
What happened to the Green Book?
Why did it end? Well, really what happened is Victor Green dies in 1960. His wife takes it over, Alma, and then she gives it to these men who were part of the New Amsterdam News, Langley Waller and Melvin Tapley, and they publish the last two editions. So in 66, the last edition is 66, 67. It's a double year edition. Really, you know, this is a couple of years after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act was in 65. So there was so much push towards integration. And, you know, I don't know if it was just because they didn't really see that it was as necessary, but it was still a big addition. But I just think it wasn't, the times were shifting. And people felt, possibly because of the New Amsterdam News in Harlem, which is a very political paper, you know, probably... if I had to guess, is that, you know, they felt like there were more. I mean, 68,
pressing.
You've got, I mean, there's, King is everywhere. So, yeah. It was a real, I think there were more, pressing issues that they felt like they had to tackle.
Candace C. Taylor, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you. This was wonderful. I feel like it's great to be in Columbus. It's great to be in my hometown. And, I'm just thankful that, we're having the book signing tonight, so thank you very much.
Candace C. Taylor is a cultural documentarian, author of a new book. It's titled Overground Railroad, The Green Book, and the Roots of Black Travel in America. She'll be at Gramercy Books tonight in Bexley, so check out the link on our website. For more information about that, go to WOSU.org/AllSides. Thanks to the All Sides staff, producer Aaron Esmott, producer Matthew Rand, All Sides interns, Atiyah Ture, Bobby Gerberic, and Max Garrison. Video production is by Rich Blue and Amber Amber Blue, and Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher, WOSU. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.